distracted in a manner that made the photo seem incidental to the moment. Now she looked at the camera dead on, like a hostage made to pose with a newspaper. Her smile felt manufactured, a product of her will. Was I imagining this? Furthermore, was it fancy on my part that her darkening gaze was a message meant for me? And what of their bodies? In the first photograph, taken in the desert, Lear was standing behind her, wrapping her with his arms. Year by year, they separated. The last one I received, in 2010, had been taken at a cafe beside a river that was unmistakably the Seine. They were sitting across from each other, far out of arm's reach. Glasses of wine stood on the table. My old roommate's was nearly empty. Liz had touched hers, not at all. At the same time, rumors began to swirl about Jonas. I had always known him to be a man of ardent, if somewhat outlandish, passions. But the stories I heard were disturbing. Jonas Lear, it was said, had gone off the deep end. His research had drifted into fantasy. His last paper, published in Nature, had danced around the subject. But people had begun to use the V word in connection to him. He hadn't published anything since, or appeared at the usual conferences, where a good deal of barroom hilarity transpired at his expense. Some of his colleagues even went so far as to conjecture that his tenure was in jeopardy. A certain amount of schadenfreude was built into our profession, the theory being that one man's fall was another man's rise. But I became genuinely worried for him. It was not long after Juliana tossed in the towel on our ersatz marriage that I received a call from a man named Paul Kiernan. I had met him once or twice. He was a cell biologist at Harvard, a junior colleague of Jonas's, with an excellent reputation. I could tell that the conversation made him uncomfortable. He had learned of our long association. The gist of his call was his concern that his tenure case might be adversely affected by his connection to Jonas. Might I write a letter on his behalf? My initial instinct was to tell him to grow up, that he was lucky to even know such a man, gossip be damned. But given the ignominious workings of tenure committees, I knew he had a point. A lot of it has to do with his wife, actually, Paul said. You've got to feel for the guy. I practically dropped the phone. What are you talking about? I'm sorry, I thought you knew, being such good friends and all. She's very sick. It doesn't look good. I guess I shouldn't have said anything. I'll write your letter, I said, and hung up. I was completely at a loss. I looked up Liz's number at Boston College and began to dial, then put the phone back in its cradle. What would I say, after so many years? What right did I have at this late date to reinsert myself into her life? Liz was dying. I'd never stopped loving her, not for a second. But she was another man's wife. At a time like this, their bond was paramount. If I had learned anything from my parents, it was that the journey of death was one that spouses took together. Maybe it was just the old cowardice returning. But I did not pick up the phone again. I waited for news. Every day I checked the Times' obituary page in a grim death watch. I was short with colleagues, avoided my friends. I had turned the apartment over to Juliana and sublet a one-bedroom in the West Village, making it easy to disappear, to recede into the fringes of life. What would I do when my Liz was gone? I realized that in some drawer of my brain I had kept the idea that someday, somehow, we would be together. Perhaps they would divorce. Perhaps Jonas would die. Now, I had no hope. Then one night, close to Christmas, the phone rang. It was nearly midnight. I had just settled into bed.
Tim?
Yes, this is Tim Fanning. I was annoyed by the lateness of the call and did not recognize the voice.
It's Liz.
My heart crashed into my ribs. I could not form words.
Hello?
I'm here, I managed to say. It's good to hear your voice. Where are you?
I'm in Greenwich, at my mother's.
I noted that she did not say my parents. Oscar was no more.
I need to see you, she said.
Of course. Of course you can. I was madly fumbling in the drawer for a pencil. I'll drop everything. Just tell me where and when. She would be taking the train into the city the next day. She had something to do first, and we planned to meet at Grand Central at 5 o'clock, before she returned to Greenwich. I left my office well ahead of time, wanting to arrive first. It had rained all day, but as the early winter darkness fell, the rain changed to snow. The subway was jammed. Everything felt like it was moving in slow motion. I arrived at the station and took my position beneath the clock with minutes to spare. The heedless crowd streamed by. Commuters in raincoats with umbrellas tucked under the arms, the women wearing running shoes over their stockings, snow clinging to everyone's hair. Many were carrying shopping bags brightly decorated for the season. Macy's, Nordstrom, Bergdorf Goodman. Just the thought of these happy, hopeful people irritated me more than I can say. How could they think about Christmas at a time like this? How could they think about anything at all? Didn't they know what was about to happen in this place? Then, she appeared. The sight of her nearly undid me. I felt as if I were awakening from a long sleep. She was wearing a dark trench coat. A silk scarf covered her hair. She threaded her way toward me through the hurrying mobs. It was absurd, but I was afraid that she would never make it, that the crowds would swallow her as in a dream. She caught my eye, smiled, and made a move-along gesture behind the back of a man who was blocking her path. I pushed my way to her.
"And there you are," she said.
What followed was the warmest, most deeply felt hug of my life. Just the smell of her drowned my senses in joy. Yet happiness was not the only thing I felt. Every bone, every edge of her pressed against me. It was as if I were holding a bird. She pulled away.
"You look great," she said.
"So do you." She gave a little laugh.
"You're such a liar, but I do appreciate the sentiment."
She removed her scarf, revealing a scrim of pale hair, the kind that grows back after chemo.
"What do you think of my new holiday do? I'm guessing you know the story."
I nodded. "I got a call from a colleague of Jonas's," he told me. "That would be Paul Kiernan, that little weasel. You scientists are such gossips."
"Are you hungry?"
"Never. But I could use a drink." We climbed the stairs to the bar on the west balcony. Even this small effort seemed to enervate her. We took a table near the edge with a view of the grand hall. I ordered a scotch, Liz a martini, and a glass of water.
"Do you remember when you met me here the first time?" I asked. "You had a friend, wasn't it? Something awful had happened."
"That's right. Lucchesi." I hadn't said the name in years. "It meant a lot to me, you know. You really took care of me."
"Comes with the service."
"But if I remember correctly, it was at least half the other way around."
"Maybe more than half."
She paused, then said,
You really do look good, Tim. Success suits you. But I always knew it would. I've kind of kept tabs. Tell me one thing. Are you happy? I'm happy now. She smiled. Her lips were thin and white. An excellent dodge, Dr. Fanning. I reached across the table and took her hand. It was cold as ice. Tell me what's going to happen. I'm going to die. That's what. I can't accept that. There has to be something they can do. Let me make some calls. She shook her head. They've all been made. Believe me, I'm not going down without a fight. But it's time to raise the white flag. How long? 4 months. 6 if I'm lucky. That's where I was today. I've been seeing a doc at Sloan Kettering. It's all over the place. His words. 6 months. It was nothing. How had I let all the years go by? Jesus, Liz, don't say it. Don't say you're sorry. Because I'm not. She squeezed my hand. I need a favor, Tim. Anything? I need you to help Jonas. I'm sure you've heard the stories. They're all true. He's in South America right now, on his great goose chase. He can't accept any of this. He still thinks he can save me. What can I do? Just talk to him. He trusts you. Not just as a scientist, but as his friend. Do you know how much he still talks about you? He follows your every move. He probably knows what you ate for breakfast this morning. That makes no sense. He should hate me. Why would he hate you? Even then, I couldn't say the words. She was dying, and I couldn't tell her. Leaving the way I did? Never telling him why? Oh, he knows why. Or thinks he does. I was shocked. What did you tell him? The truth. That you finally figured out you were too good for us. That's insane. And it wasn't the reason. I know it wasn't, Tim. A silence passed. I sipped my drink. Announcements were being made. People were hurrying to their trains, riding into the winter dark. We were a couple of good soldiers, you and I, Liz said. She gave a brittle smile. Loyal to a fault. So he never figured out that part. Are we talking about the same Jonas here? He couldn't even imagine such a thing. How has it been with him? I don't just mean now. I can't complain. But you'd like to. She shrugged. Sometimes. Everyone does. He loves me. He thinks he's helping. What else could a girl ask for? Somebody who understood you. That's a tall order. I don't think I even understand myself. I felt suddenly angry. You're not some high school science project, damn it. He just wants to feel noble. He should be here with you, not trooping around, where was it, South America? It's the only way he has of dealing with this. It's not fair. What's fair? I have cancer. That isn't fair. I understood then what she was saying to me. She was afraid. And Jonas had left her alone. Maybe she wanted me to bring him home. Maybe what she really needed was for me to tell him how he'd failed her. Maybe it was both. What I knew was that I'd do absolutely anything she asked. I became aware that neither of us had spoken for a while. I looked at Liz. Something was wrong. She'd begun to perspire, though the room was quite cold. She took a shuddering breath and reached weakly for her glass of water. Liz, are you all right? She sipped. Her hand was shaking. She returned the glass to the table, nearly spilling it, dropped her elbow, and braced her forehead against her palm.
I don't think I am, actually. I think I'm going to faint.
I rose quickly from my chair. We need to get you to a hospital. I'll get a cab. She shook her head emphatically. No more hospitals. Where then? Can you walk?
I'm not sure.
I threw some cash onto the table and helped her to her feet. She was on the verge of collapse, giving me nearly all of her weight.
You're always carrying me, aren't you?
She murmured. I got her into a cab and gave the driver my address. The snow was falling heavily now. Liz leaned back against the seat and closed her eyes.
The lady okay? The driver asked.
He was wearing a turban and had a heavy black beard. I knew he meant, is she drunk?
The lady looks sick. No puking in my cab.
I handed him $100 bill. Does this help? The traffic was like glue. It took us nearly 30 minutes to get downtown. New York was softening under the snow. A white Christmas. How happy everyone was going to be. My apartment was on the second floor. I would have to carry her. I waited for a neighbor to come through the door and asked him to hold it open, guided Liz out of the cab and lifted her into my arms. Wow, my neighbor said. She doesn't look too good. He followed us to my apartment door, took the key from my pocket, and opened that as well.
Do you want me to call 911?
He asked.
It's okay, I've got this.
She had a little too much to drink is all. He winked despicably.
Don't do anything I wouldn't do.
I got her out of her coat and carried her into the bedroom. As I lay her on my bed, she opened her eyes and turned her face toward the window.
It's snowing, she said,
as if this were the most amazing thing in the world. She closed them again. I removed her glasses and shoes, draped a blanket over her, and doused the lights. There was an overstuffed chair close to the window where I liked to read. I sat down and waited in the dark to see what would happen next. Some time later, I awoke. I looked at my watch. It was nearly 2 a.m. I went to Liz and placed my palm to her forehead. She felt cool, and I believed that the worst had passed. Her eyes opened. She looked around cautiously, as if she wasn't quite sure where she was. How are you feeling? I asked. She didn't answer right away. Her voice was very soft.
Better, I think. Sorry to scare you.
That's perfectly all right. It happens sometimes like that, but it goes away. Until sometime when it doesn't, I guess. I had nothing to say to that. Let me get you some water. I filled the glass in the bathroom and brought it to her. She lifted her head off the pillow and sipped.
I was having the strangest dream, she said.
The chemo is what does it. This stuff's like LSD. I thought that was over, though. A thought occurred to me.
I have a present for you.
You do? Wait here. I kept her glasses in my desk. I returned to the bedroom and placed them in her hand. She studied them for a long moment.
I was wondering when you'd get around to giving these back.
I like to put them on sometimes.
And here I didn't get you anything. I'm just appalling.
She was crying, just a little. She looked up, meeting my eye.
You're not the only one who blew it, you know.
Liz? She reached out her hand and touched my cheek.
It's funny. You can live your whole life and then suddenly know that you didn't do it right at all.
I wrapped her fingers with my own. Outside, the snow fell upon the sleeping city.
You should kiss me, she said.
Do you want me to? I think that's the dumbest thing you've ever said. I did. I brought my mouth to hers. It was a soft, quiet kiss. Peaceful would be the word. The kind that obliterates the world and makes all time turn around it. Infinity in a moment. The hem of creation brushing the face of the waters. I should stop, I said. No, you shouldn't. She began to unbutton her blouse. Just please be careful with me. I'm kind of breakable, you know. 21. We became lovers. I don't think I'd ever truly understood the word. I don't mean just sex, though there was that. Unhurried, meticulous, a form of passion I had never known existed. I mean that we lived as richly as two people ever could, with a feeling of absolute rightness. We left the apartment only to walk. A deep cold had followed the snow, sealing the city in whiteness. Jonas's name was never mentioned. It wasn't a subject we were avoiding. It had simply ceased to matter. We both knew she would have to return eventually. She could not simply step out of her life. Nor could I imagine the two of us being apart for 1 minute of the time she had left. I believed she felt the same. I wanted to be there when it happened. I wanted to be touching her, holding her hand, telling her how much I loved her as she faded away. One morning the week after Christmas, I awoke in bed alone. I found her in the kitchen, sipping tea, and knew what she was about to tell me. I have to go back. I know, I said. Where? Greenwich first. My mother must be worried. Then Boston, I suppose. She didn't have to say more. Her meaning was plain. Jonas would be home soon. I understand, I said. We took a cab to Grand Central. Few words had been spoken since her announcement. I felt like I was being taken to face a firing squad. Be brave, I told myself. Be the sort of man who stands tall with his eyes open, waiting for the gun's report. Her train was called. We walked to the platform where it awaited. She put her arms around me and began to cry. I don't want to do this, she said. Then don't. Don't get on the train. I felt her hesitancy. Not just the words. I felt it in her body. She couldn't make herself let go. I have to. Why? I don't know. People were hurrying past. The customary announcement crackled overhead. All aboard for New Haven, Bridgeport, Westport, New Canaan, Greenwich. A door was closing. Soon, it would be sealed. Then come back. Do what you have to do, and then come back. We can go someplace. Where? Italy? Greece? An island in the Pacific, it doesn't matter. Somewhere nobody can find us. I want to. Say yes. A frozen moment. Then she nodded against me. Yes. My heart soared. How long do you need to tie things up? A week? No, two. Make it 10 days. Meet me here, under the clock. I'll have everything ready. I love you, she said. I think I did from the start. I loved you even before that. A last kiss. She stepped toward the train, then turned and embraced me again. 10 days, she said. I made ready. There were things I needed to do. I composed a hasty email to my dean, requesting a leave of absence. I wouldn't be around to know if it had been accepted, but I hardly cared. I could imagine no life beyond the next 6 months. I called a friend who was an oncologist. I explained the situation, and he told me what would happen. Yes, there would be pain, but mostly a slow receding. "It's not something you should manage on your own," he said. When I didn't reply, he sighed. "I'll phone in a prescription." "For what?" "Morphine. It will help." He paused. "At the end, you know, a lot of people take more than they should, strictly speaking." I said I understood and thanked him. "Where should we go?" I had read an article in the Times about an island in the Aegean where half the population lived to be 100. There was no valid scientific explanation. The residents, most of whom were goat herders, took it as a fact of life. A man was quoted in the article as saying, "Time is different here." I bought 2 first-class tickets to Athens and found a ferry schedule online. A boat traveled to the island only once a week. We would have to wait 2 days in Athens. But there were worse places. We would visit the temples, the great, indestructible monuments of the lost world. Then vanish. The day arrived. I packed my bags. We would be going straight from the station to the airport for a 10 p.m. flight. I could barely think straight. My emotions were an indescribable jumble. Joy and sadness had fused together in my heart. Foolishly, I had planned nothing else for the day and was forced to sit idly in my apartment until late afternoon. I had no food on hand, having cleaned out the refrigerator, but doubted I could have eaten anyway. I took a cab to the station. 5 o'clock was, once again, the appointed hour. Liz would be taking an Amtrak train to Stamford to see her mother in Greenwich one last time, then a local to Grand Central. With each passing block, my feelings annealed into a pure sense of purpose. I knew, as few men did, why I had been born in the first place. Everything in my life had called me forward to this moment. I paid the cabbie and went inside to wait. It was a Saturday, the crowds light. The opalescent clock faces read 4:36. Liz's train was due in 20 minutes. My pulse quickened as the announcement came over the speakers. "Now arriving at track 16. I considered going to the platform to head her off, but we might lose each other in the crowd. Passengers surged into the main hall. Soon it became clear that Liz was not among them. Perhaps she had taken a later train. The New Haven line ran every 30 minutes. I checked my phone, but there were no messages. The next train came, and still no Liz. I began to worry that something had happened. It did not occur to me yet that she had changed her mind, though the idea was waiting in the wings. At 6 o'clock, I called her cell, but it went straight to voicemail. Had she shut it off? Train by train, my panic grew. It was now obvious that Liz would not be coming, and yet I continued to wait. To hope. I was hanging by my fingertips over an abyss. Time and again I tried her cell with the same result. "This is Elizabeth Lear. I'm not available to take your call." The clock's hands mocked me with their turning. It was 9, then 10. I had waited 5 hours. What a fool I'd been. I left the station and began to walk. The air was cruel. The city seemed like a huge dead thing, some monstrous joke. I did not button my coat or put on my gloves, preferring to feel the pain of the wind. Some time later I looked up to find I was on Broadway, near the Flatiron. I realized I had left my suitcase at the station. I thought to go back and retrieve it. Surely somebody would have turned it in. But the flame of this impulse quickly extinguished itself. A suitcase. Who cared? Of course, there was the morphine to consider. Perhaps whoever found it would enjoy themselves. Drinking myself blind seemed like the next logical step. I entered the first restaurant I came to in the lobby of an office building, sleek and upscale, full of chrome and stone. A few couples were still eating, though it was after midnight. I took a place at the bar, ordered a scotch, finished it before the bartender had returned the bottle to the rack and requested a refill. "Excuse me, you're Professor Fanning, aren't you?" I turned to the woman sitting a few stools away. She was young, a little heavy but quite striking, Indian or Middle Eastern, with raven black hair, full cheeks, and a bow-shaped mouth. Above her generically sexy black skirt, she wore a filmy top the color of cream. A glass of something with fruit in it sat on the bar in front of her, its rim stained with crescents of rust-colored lipstick. "I'm sorry?" She smiled. "I guess you don't remember me." When I didn't reply, she added, "Molecular Biology 100? Spring 2002? "You were my student." She laughed. "Not much of one. You gave me a C-. "Oh, sorry about that. Trust me, no offense taken. The human race has a lot to thank you for, actually. Many people are alive today because I didn't go to med school." I had no recollection of her. Hundreds of young women like her came and went from my classes. It is also not the same thing to see someone from the distance of a podium at 8 o'clock in the morning, wearing sweatpants and furiously tapping a laptop, as to find them sitting three stools away in a bar, dressed for a night of adventure. "So, where did you end up?" A dull remark. I was simply looking for something to say, since conversation was now inevitable. "Publishing, where else?" She leveled her gaze at me. "You know, I had the biggest crush on you. I'm talking major. A lot of the girls did." I realized she was drunk, making such a confession without even telling me her name. "Miss..." She moved to the stool next to mine and extended her hand. Her nails were perfectly manicured, painted to match her lips. "Nicole. It's been a long night for me, Nicole. I could sort of tell the way you put away that scotch." She touched her hair for no reason. "What do you say, Professor? Buy a girl a drink. It's your chance to make up for that C." She was plainly amusing herself, a woman who knew what she had, what it could do. I glanced past her. Just a handful of other people were in the room. "Aren't you with anyone?" She gave a little laugh. Like, did my date step out for a smoke? I felt suddenly flustered. I hadn't meant the question as a come-on. "I mean, a pretty girl like you." I just assumed.
"Well, you assumed wrong."
With the tips of her fingers, she picked a cherry from her glass and raised it slowly to her lips. Her eyes locked onto my face. She placed it on her tongue, balancing it there for a half second before popping the stem and curling the red meat into her mouth. It was the hokiest thing I'd ever seen.
"Don't you know, Professor? Tonight, I'm all yours."
We were in a taxi. I was very drunk. The cab was bouncing through narrow streets, and we were kissing like teenagers, drinking each other's mouths in furious gulps. I appeared to have lost all volition. Things were simply happening of their own accord. There was something I wanted. I didn't know what. One of my hands had found its way up her skirt, lost in a feminine country of skin and lace. The other was lifting her buttocks toward me, pulling our hips together. She unlatched my trousers and eased me free, then dropped her head to my lap. The cabbie glanced back, said nothing. Up and down she went, my fingers entwined in the lush mane of her hair. My head was spinning. I could hardly breathe. The taxi halted. 27:50, the driver said. It was like being splashed by cold water. I hurriedly rearranged myself and paid. When I exited the car, the girl, Natalie, Nadine, was already waiting on the steps to her building, smoothing down the front of her skirt. Something loud and large was rattling overhead. I thought we might be in Brooklyn, near the Manhattan Bridge overpass. More grappling at the door, and she pushed me away. Wait here. Her face was flushed. She was breathing very fast. I have something to take care of. I'll buzz you in. She was gone before I could object. Standing on the sidewalk, I tried to reassemble the order of the night's events. Grand Central, the hours of hopeless waiting, my desolate walk through the icy streets, the warm oasis of the bar, and the girl, Nicole, that was it, smiling and moving closer and putting her hand on my knee and the two of us making our hasty, inevitable exit. I could remember these things, yet none of them seemed completely real. Abandoned in the cold, I felt a rush of panic. I did not want to be alone with my thoughts. How could she have done it? How could Liz have left me standing there, train after train? If the door didn't buzz soon, I knew I would literally detonate. A few agonizing minutes passed. I heard the door open and turned in time to see a woman emerge from the building. She was older, heavyset, perhaps Hispanic. Her body, buried in a bunchy down coat, was hunched against the wind. She had failed to notice me standing in the shadows. I slid behind her and grabbed the door just before it closed. The lobby encased me with its sudden warmth. I scanned the mailboxes. Nicole Foroud, apartment 0. I descended the stairs to the basement, where a single door awaited. I knocked with my knuckles, then when no one responded, with my fist. My frustration was indescribable. My feelings had annealed to a pure desperation, almost like anger. My fist was raised again when I heard footsteps inside. The complicated unlocking of a New York apartment door commenced. Then it opened just enough for me to see the girl's face on the other side of the chain. She had taken off her makeup, revealing an otherwise plain face, flawed by traces of acne. Another man would have understood the meaning, but my agitation was such that my brain could not compute the data. "Why did you leave me?" "I don't think this is a good idea. You should go." "I don't understand." Her face was as rigid as a blind man's. "Something's come up. I'm sorry." How could this be the same girl who had laid siege to me in the bar? Was this some kind of game? I wanted to blow the chain off its anchors and burst through the door. Maybe that was what she wanted me to do. She sort of seemed the type. "It's late. I shouldn't have left you out there, but I'm going to shut the door now. Please, just let me warm up for a minute. I promise I'll go after that." "I'm sorry, Tim. I had a good time. Maybe we can do it again sometime. But I really have to go." I'll admit it. Part of my mind was computing the strength of the chain that held the door. "You don't trust me. Is that the reason?" "No, that's not it. It's just..." She didn't finish. "I swear I'll behave. Whatever you want." I offered a sheepish smile. "The truth is, I'm still a little drunk. I really need to sober up.
I could see the indecision in her face. My appeal was doing its work.
Please, I said. It's freezing out there.
A moment passed. Her face relaxed.
Just a few minutes, okay? I have to be up early.
I held up three fingers. Scout's honor. She closed the door, undid the chain, and opened it again. Disappointingly, the skirt and filmy top had been replaced by a robe and a shapeless flannel nightgown. She stepped aside to let me enter.
I'll put on some coffee.
The apartment had a dingy look, a small living area with high-set windows facing the street, a galley kitchen with dishes teetering in the sink, a narrow hallway that led, presumably, to the bedroom. The couch, which faced an old tube-style television, was heaped with laundry. There were few books in sight, nothing on the walls except a couple of cheap museum posters of water lilies and ballerinas.
Sorry it's such a mess, she said, and waved at the sofa. Just shove that stuff aside if you want.
Nicole's back was to me. She filled a pot at the tap and began to pour the water into a stained coffee machine. Something peculiar was happening to me. I can only describe it as a kind of astral projection. It was as if I were a character in a movie, observing myself from a distance. In this divided state, I watched myself approach her from behind. She was sifting ground beans into the machine. I was about to put my arms around her when she sensed my presence and spun toward me.
What are you doing?
My body was pressing her against the counter. I began to kiss her neck.
What do you think I'm doing?
Tim, stop.
I mean it.
I was burning from within. My senses were swarming. God, you smell so good. I was licking, tasting. I wanted to drink her.
You're scaring me. I need you to leave.
Say you're her. Where were these words coming from? Who was talking? Was it me? Say it. Tell me how sorry you are.
God damn it, stop!
With surprising strength, she shoved me away. I fell against the counter, barely staying on my feet. When I looked up, she was pulling a long knife from a drawer. She aimed it at me like a pistol.
Get out!
Darkness was spreading inside me.
How could you do it? How could you leave me standing there?
I'll scream.
You bitch. You fucking bitch.
I lurched toward her.
What were my intentions? Who was she to me, this woman with the knife?
Was she Liz? Was she even a person? Or merely a mirror in which I beheld the image of my wretched self?
To this day, I do not know.
The moment seems the property of another man entirely. I do not say this to exonerate myself, which is impossible, only to describe events as accurately as I can. With one hand I reached to cover her mouth, with the other I grabbed her arm, jerking the knife downward. Our bodies collided in a soft crash, and then we were falling to the floor, my body on top of hers, the knife between us.
The knife.
The knife. As we hit the floor, I felt it. There was no mistaking the sensation or the sound it made. The events that followed are no less strange to my memory, benighted by horror. I was in a nightmare in which the great, unrecallable act had been committed. I rose from her body, a pool of blood, rich and dark, almost black, was spreading beneath it. More was on my shirt,
a crimson splash. The blade had entered just below the girl's sternum, driven deep into her thoracic cavity by my falling weight. She was looking at the ceiling. She let out a little gasp, no louder than a person would make who had suffered a mild surprise. "Is my life over? Is that all? This stupid little thing, and that's the end?" Bit by bit, her eyes lost focus. An unnatural stillness eased across her face. I turned to the sink and vomited. The decision to hide my tracks was not one I recall making. I did not have a plan. I merely enacted one. I did not yet think of myself as a killer. Rather, I was a man who had been involved in a serious accident that would be misunderstood. I stripped to my undershirt. The girl's blood had not seeped through. I cast my eyes around for the things I might have touched. The knife, of course. That would have to be disposed of. The front door? Had I touched the knob? The frame? I had seen the shows on television, the ones with the good-looking detectives combing crime scenes for the minutest evidence. I knew their prowess to be wildly overstated for dramatic purposes, but they were my only reference. What invisible traces of me were even now touching down upon the surfaces of the woman's apartment, awaiting collection and study, pointing to my guilt? I rinsed my mouth and washed the knobs and sink with a sponge. The knife I cleaned as well, then wrapped it in my shirt and deposited it carefully in the pocket of my coat. I did not look at the body again. To do so would have been unbearable. I scrubbed the counters and turned to appraise the rest of the apartment. Something seemed different. What was I seeing? I heard a sound, coming from down the hall. What is the worst thing? The deaths of millions? A whole world lost? No. The worst thing is the sound I heard. Details I had failed to notice emerged in my vision. The pile of laundry, full of tiny pink garments, the bright toys of plush and plastic strewn across the floor, the distinctive fecal aroma masked by sweet powder. I remembered the woman I had seen coming from the building. The timing of her departure had been no accident. The sound came again. I wanted to flee, but could not. That I had to follow it was my penance. It was the stone I would carry for life. Slowly I moved down the hall, terror accompanying my every step. A pale, vigilant light shone through the partly open door. The odor grew stronger, coating my mouth with its taste. At the threshold I paused, petrified, yet knowing what was required of me. The little girl was awake and looking about. 6 months, a year. I was not a good judge of these things. A mobile of cardboard cut-out animals dangled above her crib. She was waving her arms and kicking her legs against the mattress, causing the animals to jostle on their strings. She made the sound again, a joyful little squeal. "See what I can do? Mama, come look." But in the other room her mother lay in a pool of blood, her eyes staring into time's abyss. What did I do? Did I fall before her and beg her forgiveness? Did I pick her up with my unclean hands, the hands of a killer, and tell her I was sorry for her motherless life? Did I call the police and take my shameful vigil beside her crib to wait for them? None of these. coward that I was, I ran. And yet, the night does not end there. You could say it never has. A flight of stairs led from Old Fulton Street to the Brooklyn Bridge walkway. At the midpoint of the bridge, I removed the knife and bloody shirt and dropped them into the water. The hour was approaching 5 a.m. Soon the city would arise. Already the traffic was thickening. Early commuters, taxis, delivery trucks, even a few bicyclists, their faces masked against the cold, whizzing past me like wheeled demons. There is no being who feels more anonymous, more forgotten, more alone than a New York pedestrian, if he so chooses. But this is an illusion. Our comings and goings are tracked to a fault. In Washington Square, I bought a cheap baseball cap from a street vendor to hide my face and found a payphone. Calling 911 was out of the question, as the call would be instantly traced. From information, I got the number for the New York Post, dialed it, and asked for the city desk. Metro, I'd like to report a murder. A woman's been stabbed. Hang on a second. Who am I speaking to? I gave the address. The police don't know yet. The door's unlocked. Just go look, I said, and hung up. I made two more calls, to the Daily News and the Times, from different payphones, one on Bleecker Street, the other on Prince. By this time, the morning was in full swing. It seemed to me I should return to my apartment. It was the natural place for me to be, and more to the point, I had no place else to go. Then, I remembered my abandoned suitcase. How this might connect me to the girl's death, I could not foresee, but it was, at the very least, a thread best cut quickly. I took the subway uptown to Grand Central. At once, I became aware of the station's heavy police presence. I was now a murderer, sentenced to a preternatural awareness of my surroundings, a life of constant fear. At the kiosk, I was directed to the lost and found, located on the lower level. I showed my driver's license to the woman behind the counter and described the bag. I think I left it in the main concourse, I said, attempting to sound like one more flustered traveler. We just had so much luggage, I think that's how I forgot it. My story didn't interest her even vaguely. She disappeared into the racks of luggage and returned a minute later with my suitcase and a piece of paper. You'll need to fill this out and sign at the bottom. Name, rank, serial number. It felt like a confession. My hands were shaking so badly I could barely hold the pen. How absurd I was being. One more filled-out form in a city that generated a felled forest of paper every day. I need to photocopy your license, the woman said. Is that really necessary? I'm in a bit of a hurry. Honey, I don't make the rules. You want your bag or don't you? I handed it over. She ran it through the machine, gave it back, and stapled the copy to the form, which she shoved into a drawer under the counter. I bet you get a lot of bags, I remarked, thinking I should say something. The woman rolled her eyes. Baby, you should see the stuff that comes in here. I took a cab to my apartment. Along the way, I inventoried my situation. The girl's apartment, as far as I could tell, was clean. I'd washed every surface I'd touched. No one had seen me enter or leave, except the cabbie. That could be a problem. There was the bartender to consider as well. Excuse me, you're Professor Fanning, aren't you? I couldn't recall if he'd been within earshot, though he'd certainly had a good look at both of us. Had I paid with cash or a credit card? Cash, I thought, but I couldn't be sure. The trail was there, but could anyone follow it? Upstairs, I opened the suitcase on my bed. No surprise, the morphine was gone,
but everything else was there. I emptied my pockets, wallet, keys, cell phone. The battery had died in the night. I plugged it into the charger on the nightstand and lay down, though I knew I would not sleep. I didn't think I would ever sleep again. My phone chirped as the battery awoke. 4 new messages, all from the same number, with a 401 area code. Rhode Island? Who did I know in Rhode Island? Then, as I was holding it, the phone rang. "Is this Timothy Fanning?" I didn't recognize the voice. "Yes, this is Dr. Fanning." "Oh, you're a doctor. That explains it. My name is Lois Swan. I'm a nurse in the ICU at Westerly Hospital. A patient was brought here yesterday afternoon, a woman named Elizabeth Lear. Do you know her?" My heart lurched into my throat. "Where is she? What happened?" "She was taken off an Amtrak train from Boston and brought here by ambulance. I've been trying to reach you. Are you her physician?" The nature of the call was becoming clear to me. "That's right," I lied. "What's her condition?" "I'm afraid that Mrs. Lear has passed away." I didn't say anything. The room was dissolving. Not just the room. The world. "Hello?" I made an effort to swallow. "Yes, I'm here." "She was unconscious when they brought her in. I was alone with her when she woke up. She gave me your name and number." "Was there a message?" "I'm sorry, no. She was very weak. I wasn't even sure I heard the number right. She died just a few minutes later. We tried to reach her husband, but apparently he's overseas. Is there anybody else we should notify?" I hung up. I placed a pillow over my face. Then I began to scream. 22. The story of the girl's death was plastered on the front pages of the tabloids for several days, and in this manner I learned more about her. She was 29, from College Park, Maryland, the daughter of Iranian immigrants. Her father was an engineer, her mother a school librarian. She had 3 siblings. For 6 years she had worked at Beckworth and Grimes, ascending to the rank of associate editor. She and the baby's father, an actor, were recently divorced. Everything about her was ordinary and admirable. A hard worker, a devoted friend, a beloved daughter and doting mother. For a time, she had wanted to be a dancer. There were many photos of her. In one, she was just a child herself, wearing a leotard and performing a little girl plié. 2 days later, I received a call from Jonas, relaying the news of Liz's death. I did my best to act surprised and discovered that I actually was a little, as if, hearing his broken voice, I were experiencing the loss of her for the first time all over again. We talked a while, sharing stories of the past. From time to time, we laughed over something funny she had done or said. At others, the phone went silent for long intervals, in which I heard him crying. I listened to the spaces in the conversation for any indication that he'd known or suspected about the two of us. But I detected nothing. It was just as Liz had said. His blindness was total. He couldn't even imagine such a thing. I was still slightly amazed that nothing had happened to me. No knock on the door, no dark men in suits standing beyond the chain, displaying their badges. "Dr. Fanning, mind if we have a word with you?" None of the stories mentioned the bartender or the cabbie, which I took to be a good sign, though eventually, I believed, the law would come calling. My penance would be extracted. I would fall to my knees and confess,
The universe could simply make no sense otherwise. I took a shuttle to Boston for the funeral. The ceremony was held in Cambridge.